space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch a cat. Fish from dusk till dawn. We make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those wooden old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California.
California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Thank you. on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html. Whew! Tired, wore out. So in the life of Mad Science, get up early and do a radio show on Saturdays, and on Sundays there's the Knights of the Round Table show where you try to address all the world's problems and such. Anyway, kind of wore out today. Apologize for that. But I posted a video link down there in the chat room over there at superchat.html. Just an individual who videotaped lightning strikes, it looks like. But got to thinking about watching when I was watching this video. What I've been trying to show people in Mad Science is essentially kind of like what Tesla was trying to show people back in the day. That lightning strike, there's a whole lot going on during that lightning strike. There's superheated air and just a lot of volts. An extreme amount of volts. A lot of heat. And so with that said, you can actually see some plasma develop around that lightning strike as it's going on. And so if you can imagine trying to figure out a way to harness the power of lightning, harness the power of what this world has to offer, there's all kinds of different ways for alternative energy that we talk about here on Mad Science all the time. We talk about hydroelectrics, thermoelectrics, wind power, solar power, and much other stuff. Earth battery technology, lead acid battery technology, and static electricity and such. But I think I want to focus this show on lightning. Because somewhere on this earth right now, somewhere on this earth there's a spot where there is so much static charge built up in the atmosphere that it basically lightnings 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year you see lightning. That sounds crazy, don't it? Well, our Earth is a one massive thermoelectric generator of epic proportions. It's got a whole lot going on. There's a whole lot of energy releases. In the ground, there's all different types of minerals. There's piezoelectrics and iron and just everything that you see out there. You know, everything that we got in front of us right now is pretty much made out of the earth. It's all chemistry and metals and such. But there's a, have to look it up. There's a deal out there where people actually go out and they collect up what they call lightning glass, fulgurites. And so when you look at fulgurite and you see that was actually created by the power of a lightning bolt, it's pretty amazing because it takes about a couple thousand degrees in order to basically melt sand in the glass. Looks like somebody's calling from the Mad Science Room. Dad, burn it, I wish y'all wouldn't do that. Throw your thumb up in there if you want to join. I'll call you. That's terrible for live radio. Alright, anyway, so basically, now that I've lost my train of thought, anyway, it takes several a couple thousand degrees at least to melt sand into glass. So that shows you that high voltage charge is coming out from the earth and the sky together. It's hot. And so basically in electricity, electronics and stuff like that, seems like heat is the worst enemy for electronics and electricity. I'm going to type a message in here in the Mad Science chat room. This is terrible for live radio, folks. Yeah, this happened again. Hi, we're live.
Good morning.
Was that you calling from the Mad Science room? No, that wasn't you. Alright, hold on, I gotta finish my message. Yeah, I can hear you. Hold on, we're live. If you want to. Doggone it. I hate this. I got to get a producer to run my shows for me because it always happens. Alright.
Well, your volume is really low this morning.
Yeah, don't surprise me none. We're live on air. We'll talk about the volume later.
I know.
Alright, so anyway, I'm going to turn this up. There, now the volume's louder on that side. Save. Alright, so now that I'm distracted, let me see if I can get myself back on track. Alright, so anyway, basically started off the show talking about lightning strikes. What's so significant about lightning strikes? There's a lot of power in a lightning strike, several thousand volts, a lot of electricity. And within that process, had a high voltage, high frequency, high electricity built up, generates a lot of heat. Enough heat to literally melt sand into glass. So it produces fulgurites, and they're pretty expensive if you ever try to go buy some samples of. there was actually a guy who was going out to the beach, and he was putting lightning rods down in the beach to try to get the lightning strike to hit them rods so he could collect the glass and then reuse the glass to make really nifty artwork stuff. Anyway, back to the point again. So I've been trying to show everybody for a long time something that Tesla was trying to show everybody for quite a bit. Back in the day, he was trying to show people literally how to harness the power of lightning. It's that simple. You know, if you look at a static discharge on a small scale, like rubbing your feet on the carpet, you're seeing lightning. That's how it works. Yeah, you build up more electrons on you, and extra electrons want to go somewhere, and they will discharge to any metal surface out there. So you get a little miniature lightning strike. Well, at the heart of that lightning strike, there's a whole lot more going on than meets the eye. For one, that energy buildup right before that discharge actually uses what is known as the Venturi effect and actually draws in more atmosphere, more power from around the surrounding surface. That's why Tesla was able to fire up those Tesla coils, and by pulsing those coils, keep ramping up the power. He sat there and he flipped the knife switch over and over again, and every time he'd get this big old surge of electricity and tried to figure out what the heck was going on here. There's a lot of pressure on the other side of that switch. And by turning it on rapidly, you release all that pressure instantaneously down in through the load there, and that's why sometimes you go in your bathroom and turn your light bulb on and doggone light bulb will burn out instantly. Too much power, big old power surge in there. So how do you utilize something that would normally be considered to be basically obnoxious? Too much heat will basically destroy a electric motor or electric appliance by, you know, breaking down the doggone insulation off the wire, and instead of 1,000 turns on your coil there, now it's basically one coil, one turn. And so since it's set close, it's going to draw a massive amount of amperage and power all in one area and just get really super hot and either blow the breaker or burn itself in half. That's basically what's going on. The tungsten element is a little tiny coil of tungsten up inside the light bulb, and it's a resistive load that basically is like a dead short. But because of the material that it's made out of and being in a vacuum, it doesn't burn up instantaneously. Instead, it generates a lot of heat, which in turn is the light you see coming out of your light bulb. And even in an average tungsten element light bulb, there's a whole lot of wasted energy involved. Science says light is heat and heat is light, vice versa. That's what the science says. And so with that said, then one has to ascertain if you can actually see the plasma, or if you can actually see the light, then you are seeing heat as well. If ever had the misfortune of going up and touching a 150-watt light bulb after it's been on for a while, you get the instantaneous hot finger effect that it's not always pleasant. So, basically while I'm rambling on about all this, I've developed a method by which I can take and instead of wasting that wasted energy, utilize that wasted energy and utilize the effect that is occurring while the lightning bolt is striking to generate plasma and focus heat energy into a vicinity to where I can then take that heat energy and transfer it out and utilize it as usable energy, such as in boiling water. Now, it's a real simple concept based on basic science, but nonetheless, it doesn't seem like the mainstream media has grasped, not the mainstream media, the mainstream science community has grasped the concept to the extent that we actually utilize this in regular life. There's a whole lot of arguments over the second law, thermodynamics, because you can't get out more energy than you put in, and so on, blah, blah, and there's all kinds of reasonings why you don't want to do this, and fears of x-rays, and all this kind of jazz. But, nonetheless, it's still powerful energy. And as much as I've been messing with the plasma technology, I ain't been radiated yet. I'm still doing just fine. But someday the science community will catch up to me and they'll start doing it. And then when it becomes their idea, then they will move forward with it. But right now it's kind of like my idea based off of some old ideas from way back in the 1800s. And so, you know, up until the point when they can accept credit and finances and, you know, whatever. When it becomes their idea, then it will get done. Otherwise, we're just talking about it for the moment. But you can literally harness the power of lightning from the smallest scale all the way up to the largest scale. You can literally use one of the most powerful forms of energy to transfer energy from one point to the next. Heat is normally something you don't want in electrical appliance, because like transistors and MOSFETs and resistors and diodes and all those, they're made up of silicone and carbon and stuff, and they don't like to get hot. They generate a lot of heat because they're a resistive load. And if they get too hot, well, hey, they burn up, just like the light bulb. It's amazing. But that resistive load right there is actually generating a really powerful energy force that is overlooked. In your automobile, you don't want too much heat because the engine block itself could crack, the pistons could crack, the valves could warp. You know, could crack the head on the block. You don't want to generate too much heat because heat is a destructive force. And so, maybe could be just the fact that we're actually looking at this the wrong way. Maybe heat is not the bad guy in this overall picture of trying to find the alternative energy source. So what I decided to do was to take what I learned from Tesla, take what I learned from science and physics and the basic negativities of what they don't want to happen. They don't want static electricity near circuitry because of obvious reasons. You basically short out things and make a mess out of stuff. So that's why you have to have a little wristband with a ground cable down to whatever when you're working on small electrical circuits and such. So heat and static electricity is a bad thing. Or is it? Imagine that lightning strike, and imagine the glass being melted. You got a massive static discharge with a lot of heat involved that is able to melt glass. That's a power force that if you could harness that power, not only would you get super high voltage DC, which can be stored, but you would generate a massive amount of heat in the process. So like I'm always saying here on Mad Science Show, if it could be done on a small scale, it could be done on a large scale and vice versa. And knowing what I've learned about how high frequencies will energize gas into the plasma state, the fourth state of matter, I put all the twos and twos together. If I can generate plasma, and I can have something in there that will allow that plasma to do its job bouncing back and forth between, say, a spark gap, I can actually tap into that heat. And instead of just seeing a nifty little pretty light or a plasma globe, I can actually utilize that energy that's inside that deal by pulling that energy out in the form of heat. So that's what the plasma reactor does. It's essentially a tuner, it's a heater, it's can be used also as an induction style coil heating system. It can be used to basically preheat fuel, get the electrons inside there all excited and vibrating and ready to go, basically getting them all excited for the journey, so to speak. With that said, utilizing this knowledge here, it has multi-purposes. It's like out there in nature, has multi-purposes. It basically will clear off the landscape by basically starting a fire where overgrown woods are. It'll burn all off and basically clear room for fresh plants to grow in there. So I call lightning nature's tree trimmer. And it'll even trim you if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. So you don't want to get hit by lightning. Don't learn electrical safety by accident. Anyway, hi Raymond, how's it going? You there?
Yeah, I had to mute my mic so I could fix it up. Lightning is very, very interesting. I mean, I can't remember if it's 300 or 3,000 lightning strikes per second worldwide. And there are certain areas that have more lightning than others. Like, for example, the state of Florida in the United States. In one 24-hour period, there's enough lightning that if you could actually conquer it and store it, it would light the city of New York for 10 years. One 24-hour period.
Well, see, we can conquer it. We can store it.
Yes, you have proven that, and so there's several others on things. But the easiest way, or actually the safest way to store lightning, is before it actually strikes. You can pull the electrons right out of the air. In fact, just barely north of my house starts a circle of 8 microwave antenna towers that are over 300 feet tall. And they've been there for over 15 years. And all 8 of them in a 1/2 mile diameter circle, not one has ever been hit by lightning, but we have anywhere from 10 to 20 lightning storms here every year. And I mean, it strikes trees, it strikes buildings, it strikes the ground. But these towers never get struck by lightning. They have a ground rod on them. Both the actual purpose of a lightning rod is not to attract the lightning bolt. It's to suck the electrons out of the air before it builds up and does discharge into a bolt. People are actually going the ground wire into the ground itself. And we've discussed this on this show several times. The easiest way, safest way, to protect yourself from lightning is to have a ground rod and have the lightning actually suck the electrons out of the air. So we have discussed putting it into a capacitor and then using a resistor to charge battery, or actually put it into the grid. So, I mean, think about that a minute. You're actually making it safe. But, and there again, you can't suck all of the lightning out of the air before it becomes lightning a strike. Because if you did, then you would ruin the ecosystem. Totally. One lightning bolt, a medium-sized lightning bolt, not small, not large, a medium-sized lightning bolt actually produces 20 tons of nitrogen and gobs of ozone, which protects the earth. The nitrogen fertilizes the ground. When it rains, it washes the nitrogen out of the air and into the ground. I have noticed many, many times, just 3 or 4 weeks without rain or whatever, in the summertime, crops start to wither. They turn a little bit brownish or yellowish color, and all of a sudden, you get this rainstorm, summer rain cloud come through, and I mean, a day later, things are really green again. Then, I've noticed in 2 or 3 weeks without rain, a thunderstorm comes through, lightning everywhere, just flashing all over the place, and it rains. And one day, so far, everything is so green, it knocks your eyes out. So you can't even think about the fact that there is so much lightning. You can't even concentrate. There's no way to perceive the idea of capturing all the lightning. Because if you did, in 24-hour period, you'd have enough energy to light the entire world for the next 50 years. So don't even try. Just pick one or two or three little spots where you get a lot of lightning.
Well,
apparatus that actually comes out of the air.
Matt, according to the National Severe Thunderstorm Laboratory, a single lightning bolt can have 100 million to 1 billion volts.
Yes.
That's a lot, man.
Yes, it is. And the thing is, the amperage goes right along with it. It's not like man. Man produces electricity. Duh. Okay, so you produce 1,000 volts at 10 amps. Okay, so if you reduce it down, then you increase the amperage. If you increase the voltage, you decrease the amperage. But a lightning bolt, when it comes out with 100,000 volts and 2,000 amps, I mean, good God, man. Come on, think about this. But you actually put your towers in the air and let it, just through friction of the air blowing across it or whatever, you know? I mean, several people, even you, have stretched a copper wire through the air and actually collected the electrons from it. That's what produces lightning bolts, is the electron imbalance of the cloud and the earth, or two clouds. As two clouds pass one another, they exchange electrons, they become positively and negatively charged. When it gets to a point it can't hold it anymore, they discharge. You can't actually collect the electrons off before it discharges. That's the safest way to do it.
Well, they say that cloud-to-ground lightning bolts are basically about 100 strikes to the earth every single second.
Yes.
Anyway.
The thing is, lightning actually, storms actually occur over the oceans, all the oceans. So, currently, think about how big the earth is. What's the surface area? They estimate there's between 6 and 8 people get hit by lightning every 24 hours, somewhere on this earth.
Once you understand how nature actually produces lightning, then you can understand how to utilize it. It's got a lot of power potential. Static electricity that's built up on your shoes is the same exact process that you see as the earth and the atmosphere become highly charged and basically ionizes the air in between the earth and ground, and then pow, you get a lightning bolt. Same thing that happens when you rub your feet on the carpet, same process. Extra electrons build up from all the ice crystals and everything in the atmosphere smashing into each other, rubbing up against each other, and exchanging electrons. The Earth is one massive thermal electric generator. And it's why I keep saying to everybody that if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it, because the Earth, in the process of doing what it does... See, when I say thermoelectrics, think about a doggone stove and the thermocouple that's inside of a stove and how that actually works. At some point, thermoelectricity, as far as on a small scale like that, you get it too hot, then it basically becomes inefficient and so on. But that's neither here nor there when you're talking about the Earth, because the Earth is so massive. It's like 25,000 miles in diameter is what science says. In that 20,000 miles in diameter, you got a depth of who knows how many feet between ground. Inside that ground, you have all kinds of different crystals and minerals and iron and stuff that is being heated up. And we know we take two dissimilar metals and we heat them up, and it produces electricity. So not only do you have that charge in the earth, but you have charge in the atmosphere as well, and when the two get high enough on each side of it, that can literally ionize the air in between. It creates a path to ground, and kapow, you get it going.
Right.
So, it's everywhere. And until the Earth stops doing what the Earth does, there's always going to be that energy potential. In the alternative energy community, a lot of things are overlooked. You don't want to do certain things because you get too much heat and it'll tear things up, or they say it takes too much power to put in to get out, you know, whatever. And that's not the case. The truth of the matter is, if you understand how nature does what nature does, and you know what you want out of that portion without, you know, basically getting nature riled up at you, you can harness the power of lightning on a small scale.
You know, you just said something profound here just a minute ago. You said something about the naysayers saying, well, you can't do this because you're not going to get this much out, that much out, blah, 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 blah. And it's all about money. So stop and think for a minute. What would it cost to build a static electric system that had no moving parts? You just put a tower up, put a lightning rod on it or something like that, that would actually attract electrons, not let it build up and create a lightning bolt, but would actually collect the electrons. Now, okay, we built Hoover Dam. How many billions of dollars did it take? How many years did it take? But yet we built it. But yet it needs to be maintained. It's free energy, but it's not really free. You have to maintain it. Hoover Dam would not produce electricity for 5 years. Within 5 years, unmanned, with no man maintaining it, in 5 years it would cease to produce electricity. In 25 years it would be destroyed.
If we had a non-conductive material that was as strong as steel, then we have the infrastructure in place right now to literally gather up more energy than we could ever use.
We have exactly what you said. There are plastics that are non-conductive and in reality form properly are just as strong as steel. They're just as tough as steel. We have wood, plywood. Plywood by weight per pound, per square foot, is 50% stronger than steel.
Well,
and we have marine plywood that you can put underwater, so therefore a little rain, snow, and ice wouldn't hurt it.
Let me explain how you would do this.
We said over and over again, we have all the technology that's needed to supply the world with all the electricity you could use. We have the technology, we're just not plugging it in right.
Let me explain to you.
Plug it into an American 110 socket. It won't work. You got to change the plug around. Plug and play. All of the technology we need is here. We just need to plug it in together.
Let me explain to you how this could be done. Earlier you mentioned about the radio towers and why they never get struck by lightning. Sometimes they do get struck by lightning, but not all the time. Very rarely. And the easy way to gather up energy is because there's actually a mathematical equation out there to tell you for how many feet you get off the ground that it goes up like 100 volts every so many feet. And when you get up to a certain height, you can get a lot of voltage out of it. But the reason why the towers aren't getting hit by lightning all the time is because they have guide wires that go all the way down to the ground. There's at least 4 guide wires on every tower so that the wind won't blow the tower over. Well, if you could put a splice into every single guide wire on that tower, then you would now have right before you essentially a collector and a spark gap that you could actually gather that energy as it was being sucked out of the air. So it's already doable. It would be so ridiculously simple as long as you had a way to splice the guide wire in a non-conductive matter And then on each side of this spark gap, you got the ground on the ground side, obviously, and you got the positive on the side that's coming down from the tower itself. The base of the tower would also have to not be grounded to the earth. So the non-conductive material would have to be basically holding up the tower itself. You understand what I'm saying here? Raymond? Did you mute your mic?
I understand exactly what you're saying. What bothers me is I'm wondering, we know this stuff, and we're nowhere near as educated as some of the engineers that are out there working for example, the cell phone company. Okay, they put these batteries in these buildings just below some tower, and they have these batteries in there, and they call them backup batteries, all right? Now, what do you think that maybe, just maybe, they've already figured out how to do what we're talking about? They're drawing that energy down and using it in those batteries, and they're not using electrical power as we know it up the grid. They're actually using those batteries. They're collecting the energy and using the energy. I mean, why else would they have them in there? It's so easy.
Check this out. Remember the old automatic antennas on your car?
Right.
So imagine you build an automatic, the equivalent of an automatic antenna every section, let's say 50 foot. Alright? Well, the very first section that's actually connected into the ground is insulated away from the ground. So it has big old ceramic or really super thick rubber insulation so that it can't ground to the dirt. There's no physical way that it can make contact with the dirt.
Right.
And then the guide wires that are connected to the deal would be on reels that can go up and down. And then inside there, you could either use hydraulic fluid or air pressure in order to raise and lower this thing up to whatever height you want. You could literally adjust the voltage by raising this thing up and down into the atmosphere.
Right.
So if you knew the equation, let's say for every 100 foot, you get 1,000 volts or whatever. All right. So you raise this thing up two sections, which is 100 feet in the air, and now you got 1,000 volts. Well, the 1,000 volts might not be enough. You need 2,000 volts. So you go 200 feet up in the air. All right? But the system would be so ridiculously simple to build. You could pull static electricity right out of the ground, and when you didn't want the thing to be able to pick up a static charge, then you could lower it all the way into the ground and basically cap it off and shut it off.
It's extremely simple to build a telescoping tower that would reach 200 feet. That would be a very, very simple process.
Well, then all you need is something, like I said, for the guide wires to keep it from swaying in the wind or blowing over, bending in half or whatever. All you would need would be some sort of really super strong non-conductive material, and you now have a telescoping power source that you can just send up in the air and grab out whatever voltage you need. If at 100 feet it's 1,000 volts and you only need, 500 volts, drop it down half the distance.
What about instead of metal guide wires, we use some kind of plastic and encode it with an anhydrous material so it couldn't get wet? Because if you use this plain, say for example, braided nylon rope, well, braided nylon rope has an ability to stretch.
Well, the guide wires is what you want. The guide wires is actually going to bring it down unless you actually use the tower itself. Now, that would be a simpler deal because you could use, in the fishing community, they got what's called spider wire. And
right.
You can make really thin wire that would be really super strong. Like that spider wire for fishing, you can't break it with your hands. You have to cut it. Otherwise, if you try to pull it apart like you do old fishing line, it'll cut your hand. That stuff is that strong.
Right.
And so you could literally use the equivalence of spider wire and build cables out of that would be non-conductive, that You could use those for your guide wires, and the actual tower itself would have a built-in spark gap. When you got it raised up in the air, then there would be a gap in between the antenna that you're raising up and the base of the tower itself, telescoping tower. And that gap is where you would collect your energy. So, what do you think?
I like it. I really do. But your idea of a telescoping tower would be perfect.
Well, yeah, because then, number one, it's going to take less material in order to do it. And number two, it would be really simple as far as if somebody had to, lift it up in the air. So essentially, the hardest part would be to get it into the hole, like whenever you load a telephone pole or a light pole into the ground naturally.
Yeah, the thing is, it could be fully automatic because you could have a computer actually measure how much electricity is actually sucking in from the air. And if it became too much, the computer would simply lower the tower.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be totally automatic. Not automatic that you push a button and it runs up and you push another button and it runs down. I mean, totally automatic.
Well, that's the simple of it. The infrastructure that we've already got in place could be modified really simple, by basically splicing into the guide wires. And you could do it while the things are, basically in place by putting another guide wire, side by side the one before you finally cut the other so that you're not getting the crud shocked out of you. And then put your new splice in between it and then release the other guide wire, and then basically you'll have a live spark gap right there.
You know, if you stop and think about it, as you're driving down a main highway, all of a sudden you have this electrical trunk line running from the power plant to a major city with 25, 30, 40 miles away. And every one of these towers are metal, okay? And they actually, because of the wind blowing across, actually make electricity. Every one of them is grounded. Because the electricity, the static electricity they built up, would actually kill you if it wasn't. If you walked up within 10 or 15 feet of one of them, it could actually bust your head open like an overripe watermelon.
Well, we don't want to bust anybody's head open, so this could be done.
The lightning rod on the top of these towers, every one of them. And you take your ground wire, you run it down to a capacitor that can hold it, and then it in turn charges batteries. The electricity from the batteries would go back into the power lines. You would need no power plant.
Yep.
All the towers would actually produce the electricity.
Well, that's the whole deal, man. It's that simple. It's that simple to be able to harness the power of lightning. And when
like I said, the infrastructure is there. We're just not plugging it all in together. All these power line towers. There's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of them throughout the United States. Why not? Why build a tower? They're already there.
Well, then if you wanted to get a little bit more high-tech and go a little bit farther back into the past when Tesla was trying to give everybody wireless energy transfer, you don't need a lot of amperage in order to produce a frequency wave. You don't need a lot of wattage.
A money-making naysayer would say, you look at the job you're ruined. Look at the job you're ruined.
I don't even listen to those people.
To build these apparatus for each one of these towers.
I don't even listen to those people. Let me finish what I'm saying. So, basically, by sending that charge that you're dragging up out of the air across the spark gap, you got one frequency going on right there, right now. You can literally shorten that spark gap to speed up that frequency. You could pulse that frequency through a primary coil and then back up another tower through a Tesla coil style design and basically send that wave out all over the place. Now you got wireless energy transfer that you don't even have to put any input. The Earth is doing all the work for you. And that's essentially what Tesla would end up doing if he'd had the opportunity to finish what he was doing. He would have been able to send a wave out all the way across the doggone globe to tower and basically bounce that energy around without having to put hardly anything into it. if anything at all, you can use the actual atmosphere itself for your power source. You plug into the atmosphere, change that energy to a different form that you want. You can adjust the frequency accordingly to where, however you want to transmit it. And there you go.
Right.
It's that simple. And if you understand frequency, then, like, let's take 50 and 60 hertz, which is the energy we use in our wall socket. Anything above 60 hertz in the standard copper wire that we use will begin to generate enough plasma and heat that will actually break down the insulation in the wire. So, over where they're using 50 hertz, their appliances will last longer than ours because it's not generating as much wasted heat. Over here in the United States where we use 60 hertz, ours would go out a little bit before theirs because they would break down sooner. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And so, you know, with that said, no, with that knowledge that at certain frequencies, you start to generate heat because it is literally causing the electrons in the copper or whatever material you're using to beat each other up. It's getting them all excited, which is generating heat. So we know really simple how to generate heat using frequency waves. Microwave ovens do it using a microwave. You don't have to have 120 volts AC or 220 volts AC in order to make a microwave. You can literally make a microwave with just the primary coil or the secondary coil alone out of the microwave oven. You can do the same job. It's the frequency range. When you take 120 volts AC on the primary, which pulses the field that makes the secondary energized, you could take the primary completely out of the picture, which they do in the new microwaves. I can't remember what the heck they call it, the technology, but basically it's using like the equivalence of a Slayer exciter circuit to energize the secondary, which in turn sends the frequency into the element inside the magnetron, which heats up, generates heat, releases electrons inside that magnetic field inside the magnetron, and guides it out into the microwave oven. So modern day microwave ovens are a heck of a lot more energy efficient than the old style because you don't have to have that primary like you do. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I got somebody at the door.
Alright, so either way, with that knowledge, using the frequency range to energize the electrons, we know we can generate heat. So that means that we don't need nowhere near the voltage that we're using to generate heat. That's what this plasma reactor does. I'm taking a 12-volt oil burner igniter. That's, I think it's... let me look here. Maximum input, 12 volts at 4.8 amps. Alright, so this thing basically will use 12 volt DC at 4.8 amps is its maximum input. It'll actually run in less. But the output on this thing is 22 kV peak at 30 milliamps. So at 30 milliamps, I can literally heat water with 30 milliamps. Well, what's that tell you? You still there, Raymond?
Yeah, I'm here. Tells you a lot.
So it's not the wattage or the amperage. That's why I keep telling everybody and keep getting myself in trouble because they don't understand what it is that I'm talking about. It's not the wattage and amperage that I care about. It's not even the current flow that I care about. It's the high voltage because the high voltage is at a higher frequency than the lower voltage because it's moving faster and it's more pressurized. So you can send a high voltage through anything and start a fire. You see what I mean?
Yes,
you can take that high voltage and you can generate the fourth state of matter being plasma. So utilizing high voltage to some extent doesn't seem like a very good idea because you're going to start a fire. But we're talking about a controlled burn, so to speak. We're talking about focusing that energy where you want it to go and then utilizing the heat that comes off of that to do whatever work it is that you need done. The doggone nuclear power plants these days are using the same concept of what I'm talking about, but with a different method. Their method is to take some naturally radioactive material, combine it into really highly radioactive rods that are depleting because they're not supposed to be compacted like that. So they're hot. They're really hot. The energy is beating the heck out of each other inside a radioactive rod, and it's trying to escape. Well, in the process of escaping, because it's so hot, it's producing an energy wave that in turn is boiling the water molecule, which is a dipole molecule, has a positive and a negative field on it. So as that energy is being released, it's vibrating those water molecules so rapidly that they're producing heat, and if it's allowed to go on long enough, will generate into superheated steam that is pressurized, and you can use that to turn turbines.
You know, I don't want to sound silly here, but isn't that how you produce fire out in the woods in a survival situation? You take two pieces of dry wood and rub them together. Well, now you can rub them and get them warm, or you can rub them really fast and actually cause them to start just catching on fire and burn.
Yeah, that's the whole deal.
What a radioactive nuclear power plant does, it has these fuel rods that give off this energy. Excites the water, causes it to rub together. I mean, even the water, with friction, heats up. I've proven that with a blender.
Yeah,
so that's the same thing. I mean, it's silly, but there again, it's reducing it down to where a person can actually understand. It's nothing more than friction. And even water reacts the same as anything else. Friction. If you get it moving fast enough, hard enough, and long enough, it will heat up.
It's friction, it's frequency, and pressure that generate the power for the heat to rise. So you could build a heater with just by rubbing two pieces of metal together. You could rub these two pieces of metal together fast enough, you could get those things to be red hot. And they would literally get to the point where they get past their, in every metal, you know, like if you have hardened steel, there's a certain temperature at which that hardened steel will begin to fail. Hold on a second. If you can keep that temperature down to right before the hardening breaks down to where that metal now becomes soft, you could rub two pieces of metal from here to eternity and generate friction, which in turn would generate heat, and never, ever destroy that those two pieces of metal. You think I'm wrong?
No, I know you're right.
Well, the same thing could be applied with bearings. If you never ever wanted bearings to fail, if you wanted bearings to be able to last forever, you find the maximum potential of what that bearing could run at before it reached the point where it made the metal soft enough to literally tear into each other. If one's harder than the other, one has a less deal. That's why they'll put like sacrificial pieces of metal in between major parts, so that the sleeve bearings will go bad before the main cam.
Right.
So it's a sacrificial deal. But if you could take that same exact system, make the metals identical to each other, and monitor the temperature, the breakdown temperature of those metals, you could literally run that same doggone engine and never tear it up. You see what I'm saying?
You're 100% positive. I mean, yes, you're exactly right. It would run forever.
So, the lubricants that we use in there, We got some high-tech synthetic lubricants that will basically, you know, keep this friction down to a certain level. Well, then we know that if we add an oil cooler to that same system, that those bearings will last yet even longer because now it's taking that energy away.
Now, here's the thing. Your oil is a lubricant. It's also a coolant.
Yeah, that's the
if
point.
If the oil starts to get hot, it could be run through a radiator and draw the heat off of it, and it would still run forever.
If you
run it so fast, it would try to overheat, but it couldn't.
If you modified any existing 5-horse Briggs & Stratton engine out there, doesn't matter what brand, whatever, if you modify any lawnmower that you got and you put basically a super cooling oil cooler on that engine will never, ever go bad.
That's right.
Because you keep
An engine oil cooler. I used to pull camper trailers a lot when I was moving around the country. That's how I got the nickname Boomer. But I was pulling camper trailers. Well, the strain on the engine would cause the oil to get really hot. But you put an engine oil cooler on it for your transmission, and there was no more problem.
Yep. And
the engine and transmission is not designed to pull heavy loads. Consequently, all you have to do is redesign it, retrofit. An engine oil cooler and a transmission oil cooler, but both. And you pull unbelievably heavy loads, your engine never gets hot, whatever, you know. And as far as your water goes, put a bigger radiator in it.
In the racing industry, they literally brutalize engines.
Yes.
And so, in order to keep these engines from destroying themselves while in the middle of a 200-lap race or something like that, they will put excellent oil and transmission coolers on them things. Even on the rear ends of the cars, they have cooling systems to cool down the rear end so that they can maintain that temperature down and get that engine and all the gears and everything to last longer.
You know, years and years ago, when they didn't pay much attention to the detail, I bought a brand new Chevrolet pickup truck. And I'm telling you right now, you stop at a stoplight, even if there was shade like a tree, it just sitting there idling, waiting for the stoplight, the engine would start to overheat. Of course, in a few minutes, the light would turn green, and before it really overheated and it damaged the engine, you'd take off and it'd start cooling again. I've run that thing on truck around for 2 or 3 years, and after 3 summers I've been sweating to death at stoplights, the stop signs. I said, the heck with this. Took it to a radiator shop and had to put a bigger. I told Vince, I said, you put the biggest radiator you can find in here that will fit in there, put the compartment without altering anything. He did. So help me, on 104 degrees, you could park this truck in the sun. This let it set and idle. It would never come up off of operating temperature. It cool it. Get rid of that heat.
Yep.
The best way to get rid of the heat is don't produce it to start with. Quit burning gasoline. Burn gasoline fumes, and your engine will not overheat.
Well, that's the thing, man. Basically, your brand new car is going to destroy itself within a few years because the way it's engineered. It's not engineered to last.
Heck no, because if it lasted, then they couldn't sell you but one car in a lifetime.
So, if you got a brand new car right off the store shelf, not the shelf, I guess they don't put cars on store shelves unless it's a Hot Wheel.
Showroom floor.
If you got a car right off the showroom floor and put it on a trailer before you ever even started driving that thing, you modified that to put on a better cooling system for the radiator, a better cooling system for the rear end, and any gear-related oiled-up unit such as your...
I didn't even think about the rear end, but you're right.
Yep.
Oil cooling or system on the rear end, oil cooling system on your
transmission,
there you go, and an engine oil cooler. You put all these on there and that car will last you 3 times as long.
Yep.
As long as you maintain them, that's the secret. You have to maintain them. Change your filters regularly. Every one of them should have a filter on it.
Well, if you was getting a proper burn, you wouldn't even have to worry about changing your oil, because the reason why oil ends up getting getting black is because actually in the piston design, the rings aren't perfectly, there's a split in every single ring. If you got two or three rings on there, they got splits inside those rings. That's how they was able to get them onto the piston themselves.
Five to seven thousandths of an inch.
Yeah. Well, those rings are also designed for when the compression is going on inside that engine, the rings actually spread out to make a better seal.
That's the whole point, what you just said. Those rings have an end gap. Now, when you start that engine up, if the gasoline going under pressure and it comes up and pressurizes, some of it will actually slip by until the engine gets up to running temperature. By running temperature means that ring has heated up to the point it's expanded and it actually comes together and it's in the gap and there's no longer a gap.
Yeah, but nonetheless, still some of that carbon that ain't being burned up in the piston is making it past the rings because of that design.
Into your oil and contaminating.
Yeah. And so
you need a filter and ever so often change your oil. 3,000 miles is ridiculous.
If you
on a car, to change your oil every 3,000 miles is absolutely stupid. It's a way to sell oil. That's why they advertise it. So they can sell oil. It's all about making money. If they made the car properly, designed it properly, it would last you a lifetime. But they couldn't sell you but one car. Think about that. They're not in the business of building something that you can take whatever. They're in the business of selling cars. So if they build it to last, they can't sell but just one car per person.
If you could re-engineer the piston design and the ring design in that engine, such as finding a material that is flame retardant, you know, will withstand a lot of heat and be able to still maintain that seal. Like in the old days, they used to use like leather for water pumps. They'd cut out a circular piece of leather and then they'd have a shaft that would go down in there and it would actually produce pressure and up pressure when you move the handle up and down. That piece of leather is going up and down that pipe, pushing and pulling the water. And those things could last for hundreds of years. And so, if you could design a soft kind of ring to go around there, or even supplement the rings that go in there to keep that blow-by from ever making it into that oil, you would never have to change your oil. Never. You wouldn't even have to have an oil filter anymore. Because absolutely none of the carbon would be able to make it down into that oil. That's what the black stuff is inside your engine oil. And the other portion of that is metal flakes from the rings, basically shaving it once it gets too hot.
Right.
It's basically shaving metal flakes off of the inside of your engine. You know, when bearings start to get hot, they're starting to shave little metal flakes off into your engine. At first it starts off little tiny microscopic pieces. And then as time goes by, eventually you get a bearing that's not perfectly round anymore, or perfectly smooth, and it's catching on one side, digging bigger chunks out until finally your main bearings fail, and then bam, your car basically breaks down on you. So by keeping the engine oil cool, by reducing the friction and keeping the seal, you could engineer an internal combustion engine that would not only get the perfect burn every single time, so there wouldn't even be no carbon to get down there, but if any did get to the point where it could have gotten down there, it can't get past the seal that you just produced for your pistons. Now, all the people that's out there in the racing industry should be, you know, like on their CAD programs right now trying to re-engineer that, because they'd be the next rich person in the auto industry, because you could design a piston that you could put in any engine and you could run the crud out of it and never have to change your oil. You realize how much money that'd be worth?
A lot.
Yeah. But, so, basically, in every single industry out there, doesn't matter what it is, heat is a bad thing. Except for when you want heat to boil water. That's right. A good thing.
And so really, in physics and engineering, there is no good and bad. It's what you want to use it for.
Well, it's bad to the extent...
Heat is bad, okay? But in a steam engine, heat is good.
Yeah. It's bad to the extent that if you get too much of it, which an internal combustion engine is capable of producing a ridiculous amount of waste heat.
Right.
And if it weren't for the cooling systems, that engine wouldn't last very long. If it wasn't for the lubrication and the cooling, then that engine would tear itself apart so fast. When your oil breaks down, the viscosity of your oil, which is the thickness of it, that's why you get all your different numbers, 10W whatever, and all the way up to 50 weight oil and gear lube and so on. That's the thickness of that oil. And so...
Back years ago, back in the 70s, I bought a dealership for Slick 50, which Slick 50 was nothing more than a really high-grade motor oil that had polytetrafluoroethylene and little tiny particles, okay? Now, a lot of people complained they put it in their engine, and it got a bad rap because people put it in their motor in an older car that didn't run for 5 or 6 years, and next thing you know, the oil filter would clog up, and the engine would burn up. But the thing is, the polytetrafluoroethylene in Slick 50 is 2 microns. Now, some people get the idea of the size of 2 microns. This would be the same as a house fly flying through a chain link fence. How in the heck could it clog up your filter? No, what happened is they were running it without Slick 50. They were running it with cheap oil, cheap gasoline, carbon building up all over the place. Slick 50 had an engine cleaner in it that would cut this material loose. It was the crap that was in your engine that was broken loose that clogged up your oil filter. People didn't understand this. So Slick 50 over the years got a bad rap. Now, in a brand new engine, totally, totally different story. I bought a brand spanking new, right off the shelf, 2 horsepower brake and straight motor. I put in Slick 50 in the thing. I ran it for 24 hours straight. To break it in, to get all the rings and everything seated in, with just plain regular motor oil. Drained it all out, put in enough of pure Slick 50, ran it for another 24 hours to coat it. Now, 12 times, okay, I drained the oil out of this engine, cranked it up, let it sit there and run until it bogged down and stopped. Each time was 45 minutes. I personally called the Briggs & Stratton company and asked to speak to the chief engineer. And I told him, I said, if you took a brand new Briggs & Stratton 2 horsepower motor, ran it with oil in it until it broke in, and then drained all the oil out and fired it up with no oil, how long would it run? And he said 6 to 8 minutes. Absolutely no longer than 8 minutes. Think about that a minute.
Yep.
That's 50. Slick 50 polytetrafluoroethylene is actually DuPont's brand name is Teflon, okay? So what happens is the particles of the Teflon are so small that they can actually enter the pores of the metal, because all the metal is porous. But under heat, friction, and compression, it'll actually pack in those pores. Now, I did a similar situation when I was much younger, 10, 15 years earlier. I had a disc. It was a tandem disc that the bearings were wore out, and it was so old that in the farm disc, the third, right? It was so old I couldn't find bearings that would fit it. So I had an old timer tell me, "Duh, make your own. Make about a well-seasoned red oak." I said, "But what's it going to do?" He said, "It'll last longer than your standard bearing because as you plow and disc your land, you're creating dust. The dust will get in there. Of course, you put oil in it." I wouldn't go into more detail, but it'd take too long. But you make it a special way. If anybody wants to know, contact me, I'll tell you. But trust me, the dust and dirt works its way in through the oil into between the red oak and your steel shaft. Well, the steel shaft, being harder than the oak, presses the granulars of sand into the wood until eventually what you actually have is a glass bearing. Think about that a minute. You have a glass bearing. You're steel is riding on smooth glass because it crushes that silicone. It crushes it and pushes it into the wood. The oil lubricates it. Buddy, let me tell you, after one season using the disc, that's it. You're running on pure glass bearing. That thing will never wear out because any of the glass that does wear, other than coming in to replace it, you just keep a little oil in it.
Well, there's a whole lot of different potentials out there for re-engineering stuff if you could only get people to think outside the box.
Right.
So, you know, all the wars that I've had with people out there over current watts and amps was only because they merely just didn't understand what it is that I was trying to point out. Heat is a bad thing when you're talking about the way the internal combustion engine is engineered. Heat is a good thing because if you want to be able to transfer energy, what better way to do it than with heat?
Right.
You know, and high voltage is pressure. Pressure is what gets work done. And right. If you're sending a high frequency of a high voltage into any material, it's going to get hot because it's actually interacting with the electrons in there producing friction, which in turn is producing heat. We use a resistive load in tungsten for a light bulb. And
right.
That means that because the tungsten doesn't want to allow electron flow through there, the energy is basically having to fight its way through. In turn, is backing up in there, and that all that power inside there is causing them electrons to beat the heck out of each other. And at certain points, when the temperature gets too hot, the element will fail. So we put that element into a vacuum so that it can withstand a heck of a lot more heat for a whole lot longer, and it will last longer. I got in my possession one of the old original Edison light bulbs. I don't even know how old it is. It's over 100 years old. But nonetheless, this thing still works. Today, still works. It's outlived hundreds, if not thousands, of light bulbs that I've replaced in my house. It still works. The man made them good back in the day. And, you know, whatever you want to say about sometimes going back in the past and learning from things that they did back in the day that lasted a lot longer and paying attention to science and physics and what's going on and why heat is actually generated and being able to build systems that, you know, it's like all the laws of physics. Maybe you can't violate the laws of physics, but what you can do is not invoke them when you know the process of how they actually occur. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And to intentionally generate static electricity and to intentionally raise a frequency level up there and to intentionally generate heat with that same process is what that plasma reactor actually does. Static electricity is bad for circuitry because on a micro scale you got literally lightning bolts running around inside there and overpowering things that basically destroy it. Heat in any system, if the heat gets too high, heat is a really powerful force and it will destroy it. Same thing with frequency. If you're pumping a high frequency wave through any electrical wire that normally holds a lot of voltage, a lot of amperage, a lot of wattage, can withstand quite a bit of power going through there, you raise the frequency up high in that same wire and you will literally burn right through the insulation of not only the wire but the plastic or rubber that they use to insulate it from you. So knowing that, you take that energy and you can generate a massive amount of heat with very little input. That's the point.
Think about this a minute. You know that dual axial flux alternator?
Yeah.
That Scott built a lot of?
Yeah.
There are no exposed connections or exposed wire that water can hurt. So if you submerge that in distilled water, which will not conduct the electricity, you can actually use it as a cooling agent and never burned the alternator out. If the water even started to get warm, you would run into a radiator system.
Well,
you could produce billions of volts of electricity and never burn the thing out, even though the wire is not designed to handle that voltage.
That's right, and if you take advice from the power company who have transformers on the power line, you'll see that those power, those transformers on there are filled with oil to absorb the heat to take it away from the coils. Otherwise, those coils wouldn't last because of the frequency range at which they're putting them in there. And
right.
So the average Joe out there messing around with Tesla technology has realized that if they submerge their transformers into oil, they can use that oil to transfer the heat. Now, if they took it one step further and put a circulating system that would take that heat, that oil, that hot oil, and run it through a radiator and blow a fan on there, they could run that thing even longer and even hotter
than
normal, because it would never meet the breakdown.
The purpose of using oil is different types of oil take different, but on the average, it's about 600 degrees before you start to damage the oil itself. So, I mean, you know, the thing is, like you just said, and you brought it right on the point too, you hit the nail straight on the head. The oil will take the heat off the coils, but now you got to get the heat off the oil. That's the whole secret. If you do that, then yes, you would run indefinitely. Absolutely indefinitely.
It would never break. It would never fail.
Oil breaks down at 600 degrees on the average. Some oils go a little hotter, some will go quite 600 degrees.
So
I think most vegetable oils will start to break down at 600-650 degrees.
So with that said, if you wanted to do something to your house in order to make your house so incredibly energy efficient that it would be ridiculous, first off, you change your lighting system, because you want to bring that lighting system to a point where it doesn't draw a lot of energy off the grid. And so the LED system seemed to be the best choice for that. The second thing is, anything in your house that takes a transformer, if you modify that transformer to literally use an oil-type system to take away the heat away from that transformer running cooler will drain less energy and will fail a lot longer than it normally, it would last a lot longer than it normally would before it actually failed.
Right.
So that heat that you take away the transformer needs to go somewhere. Well, you could transfer that heat from the cooling system that you got instead of into the atmosphere or even into the room itself by using that, like now I'm sitting next to some three or four computers that are on and monitors that are producing heat that's warming up the room. At a certain point, I gotta turn the actual heater off because these systems right here will automatically generate enough heat because of the process of what's going on in the processors and all that. They generate heat, all right?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned your computers. I've only got one computer running in my office, but I also have a refrigerator, and I've got a little negative ion generator up here that keeps all the smells out of my office. I've got a microwave connection of it. My office, in the wintertime, is always, with no heat other than what I'm using in the office, it's always 10 degrees warmer in this office than it is outside. Now, here's another thing. In the summertime, my office is always 10 degrees cooler than outside.
Yep.
Because of the sun is generating heat outside.
So,
and the office is shaded inside. So, I mean, I've got a beautiful situation here. You know, I insulated the walls and ceiling of my office. I built it myself, or had it built. I mean, I supervised every nail that went everywhere. But I built it to be efficient, you know?
You could put up.
No matter what the temperature is outside in the wintertime, my office is always 10 degrees warmer. In the summertime, it's 10 degrees cooler. I don't even turn the air conditioner on in the summertime most of the time. I just leave the door open. And it's 10 degrees cooler in here, so if I start feeling warm, right, I go out and stand in the sun for 5 minutes. I walk back in here for 30, 40 minutes, I'm comfortable as heck. It feels like air conditioning.
you could put a water cooling system on all your electronics. You could put a cooling system on your refrigerator, because the refrigerator has a compressor which in turn generates heat that has to have a deal on the back of it to disperse that heat out into your room. So you actually notice that if you feel the back of your refrigerator, it's hot. Or feel the back of the freezer, it's hot.
I just had a thought here, she says. What if, say like in the wintertime, you want the heat off the back side of your refrigerator, right? So if you built a little box, say 3 or 4 inches thick, the size of the back of your refrigerator, now your refrigerator already has a fan in it to blow the heat off. Then you could run a pipe, just have an opening on the side, right? That what you would sweat out, and an opening off the back would go through the wall. So in the summertime, you would close the one to the inside of the house and open the one to the outside.
Yeah, if the back of your refrigerator was actually outside, then that heat would be transferred outside and basically just dispersed into the atmosphere, whether it's hot or cool, and it wouldn't be inside your house, so you'd be cooling. But if you wanted to shut a little flap and basically keep that heat inside your house, that's a little bit of extra heat. Right. Also, if you use some thermoelectrics like the Peltier elements, I wonder how many Peltier elements you could stick to the back of your refrigerator and recover some of that wasted heat into usable power that you could charge batteries up. So,
I don't know if recover the heat is the proper word, specifically, but you're not recovering. Yes, you are. The refrigerator takes the heat out of the inside and throws it away. Well, right now your refrigerator is throwing it away in your house 24/7 year round. All we're doing is talking about the heat is taken out of your house and putting it back in the house in the wintertime.
Yeah, but what I'm also saying, though, is that while you're sending it out of the house or in the house, you can use the temperature difference between one side of that Peltier element to the other side to generate electricity to charge your batteries and stuff. So instead of plugging in another adapter in the wall to charge your cell phone, you just have this gizmo on the back of your doggone refrigerator, since it's running anyway, and the temperature difference will put the charge on your phone. So you don't even need to plug in a cell phone charger anymore, because you're using the waste heat off of the refrigerator to do the job.
You're fine, right. You put your cell phone charger in your refrigerator, so you just plug your cell phone into your refrigerator, and the heat that you're drawing out of the house actually charges your cell phone.
So there's a money-making gizmo for you folks. Go out there, buy you some Peltier elements, make some clips, 3D printed clips that you can snap on that screen on the back of your refrigerator where you feel all that heat being wasted, and measure the voltage, and then you'll know how much you got to step it down to charge your cell phone. And then you could sell that to everybody and his brother out there, and they can charge their cell phone without ever having to plug a cell phone charger into the outlet drawing more voltage, because those things, they start off using 120 volts and they step it down to what, 5 or some odd volts for a USB charger.
You know what we're talking about here, don't you?
What?
We're talking about altering your refrigerator so it acts like an air conditioner.
Yeah, you got a thermoelectric generator right in your house.
Right in your house. And you take some half inch that blue plastic coated styrofoam. Elmer's wood glue will glue that stuff together. There's other glues that would work. You can make your box the same size as your refrigerator in the back, and have your outlet come straight out the back and go through the wall. Have another outlet on the side, and then all you simply do is in the wintertime, you would close the outside vent and open the inside vent. In the wintertime, it would take the heat in your house. When you open the door, the heat goes in the refrigerator. You close the door, it draws the heat off and expels it out to outside.
And your refrigerator would last longer because you would be controlling the temperature.
It would last a lot longer if you did it right, but you'd have to do it right. You'd have to make sure your fan, the coolant, was still putting out the same amount of air.
So there's so many different possible solutions to what we're talking about that it's just mind-blowing.
Yep. You know, the thing is, when you start to try to cool something in a system like we're talking about, you can get too little airflow over your heated object. But there again, you cannot get too much. So whatever your fan's doing, the safest thing to do would be to change it out, which would be $10 or $15, and make sure you got one that put out more volume of air. That way you wouldn't burn your refrigerator up.
All right, well,
that's a safe thing to do, I'm sorry. But you could actually use your refrigerator as an air conditioner assist, and you would drop your air conditioning bill drastically. In a year's time, you would definitely notice the difference.
Basically, what I'm trying to point out to is right now, we got all the technology to make our houses so incredibly energy efficient that even the way that they're designed wouldn't matter anymore, because you're not losing anything anymore. See, your house is fighting against itself energy wise in order to try to give you the comforts that you want. And if you learn a few tricks from science, then you can take that same exact house that you got and re-engineer it to do everything so efficiently. You know, they got these Energy Star devices that they call, you know, like refrigerators. They got a little tag you put, says the Energy Star on there, and says it's energy efficient. Even those have a lot of wasted energy. Now, using something like a Pelletier element on the back of, how many Pelletier elements can you fit on the back of a refrigerator coil? Quite a few. And that heat don't care where it goes, it's gonna go. And so if there's a temperature difference between one side of that Pelletier element and on the opposite side, it's going to generate a voltage.
Yep.
And you could turn your doggone refrigerator into a generating system to charge up battery power. Anything out there that has heat, any kind of energy, doesn't matter what frequency range it is, all the way from the down in the hertz range up to the terahertz range and in the negative realm as well, forward and backwards to infinity and beyond, are tons and tons and tons and tons of frequencies. All of those are energy waves that can be stored. Science says that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So it's not going anywhere. You plug it into the plug your deal in the wall, you use energy of one form that transforms it into energy of another form. That use of that energy creates waste energy that goes out the other side into another form. That energy is going to go where necessary.
What do you think?
Huh?
Oh, I've got somebody in the office. I just asked him what he thought about what you were talking about.
Yeah, so basically, there ain't one single appliance that you own right now that you couldn't be tapping off of and storing energy from. And so what I'm saying here with this plasma reactor design, we have right now the capabilities that if they would have known back in the late 1800s what we know now, there would never been a nuclear power plant, because we can do the same exact thing that a nuclear power plant does, we can do with high frequency waves. And high frequency waves, that's not going to hurt anybody. You know, we're not talking about microwaves on a massive scale that's going to, you know, send, basically, because your body's 3/4 water, going to rock the water molecules in your body until you fry. We're talking about, right now, we're sitting in a sea of energy waves. And if you focus that energy properly into the right system, you could literally build a high voltage system that would boil water on demand, run the same turbines to run the cruddy old inefficient systems that man has got going on. We waste more energy than we use. And so, if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it. If you re-engineer the machines that you got right now, you can have them things, even an internal combustion engine could be perfectly engineered to where it wouldn't even have any exhaust to come out there that you could smell or that would be hazardous. It's the waste that's going on. Only 30 to 36% of that energy is actually makes it down to moving your car from point A to point B. The rest of it is wasted fuel right out the back, and what is reclaimed through the catalytic converter isn't very much. So you only get like 36 maximum efficiency out of the fuel that you burn in your car. We can get 100% efficiency out of it just by a little modifications using some basic science and some basic physics. We can re-engineer any engine out there to run so incredibly efficient that, you know, your fuel costs would drop to the dirt. And if you want it done, don't wait around for the auto industry to do it, because they ain't gonna do it. They ain't gonna do it. They all have buddy systems going on in all the major industries. My back scratch, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, kind of thing. You know, I'm gonna work with you and you work with me, and if we make cars to fail, then we can sell more cars, and if we make cars inefficient, you can sell more gas, and so on. If you think that's not the truth, then go back and ask J.P. Morgan why he shut Tesla down. Couldn't put a meter on it. Wasn't a way to make no money off of it. So what's the point? You didn't want everybody having free electricity because...
All right. What about Lee Iacocca?
Who?
Lee Iacocca.
What about him?
What about him? He's the guy that just did exactly what you're talking about. He is the guy that got all the automotive engineers to deliver... deliberately designed automobiles where the average person cannot work on. Well, I mean, there were Model T, Model A, Fords, and all the way up until the early 50s, anybody with half a brain and a couple of wrenches could work on an automobile. Now, you can't. They deliberately designed them where you cannot work on them. You have to have specialized tools, specialized training.
Well, yeah, you sell more tools that way.
It's selling cars left and right, but everybody could work on them. So nobody would buy new cars, they would buy old cars and work on themselves. So the automobile dealerships were going out of business. They were going bankrupt. I mean, two or three a week. So yes. they put Lee Iacocca in charge of Chrysler, and he's the one that got all the engineers together to redesign the automobile where you could work on it. Therefore, you had to take it to the dealer. Dealers weren't making any money. But now, making money off of working on the new car when they break down. And it deliberately made them to where they would break down so they could sell you another car or pay the dealerships to work on them. Think about it. I mean, it's all about money. There's no big industry out there that's interested in building an automobile that will last forever. They're not interested in it.
I'm going to say something crazy. Because I always say something crazy. That's why I'm Shaziz, mad science guy. Properly engineered... and using what we spoke about, the knowledge of what causes things to break down and the friction at certain temperatures, things will begin to burn. You could literally design a wooden engine, internal combustion engine, that would do the same exact job as all the other engines out there, as long as you could bring that heat away from that wood to the point where it never met the point where it could actually burn.
Oh, yeah.
No problem.
None.
You know, I don't care if people think I'm crazy anymore.
That's obvious.
I understand physics. I understand science. And the only purpose for me even saying something like, you know, building an engine out of wood, which would be a brilliant thing to do because that would... just literally blow people's mind. This engine's made completely out of freaking wood. And you pick your favorite colored wood and actually, varnish it and shellac it and make it look beautiful, you know? And put it in a wooden car, for that matter. Who cares? Nonetheless, if you understand the science and the physics and you can keep it from getting up to, I think the actual paper will actually burn at around about 300 and some odd degrees. Alright? So if you can keep that engine down to under 300 and some odd degrees before the friction starts to cause it to heat up to the point where it finally self-ignites or whatever, that engine would run forever.
My choice of rubber or wood to build that engine out of would be, my first choice would be locust, my second choice would be teak, because they're extremely dense, hard woods. And once they cure it out, They're almost impossible to destroy.
Mine would be Hedge, because Hedge actually has natural oil in it.
It would be what?
Hedge. What they call Missouri Orange.
You're talking about the horse apple tree?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I can't think of the actual name of
the tree. Yeah, they call it. Some people call it...
That would be a toss-up between teak and the horse apple tree.
Yeah, hedge trees have natural oil in them. And so you have a self-lubricating cylinder with the hedge trees. And the wood itself, once that stuff gets hard, man, it's like concrete. That stuff is durable.
Oh, and yeah. When it's green, you can cut it with a chainsaw, chisel, a pocket knife, whatever you want. But once it cures out, no pocket knife will cut it.
That's what I'm going to do, man. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to cut down a piece of hedge. And I'm gonna take my go down to my friend's house down there. We're gonna engineer a wooden one single cylinder two stroke engine out of a log and run that doggone thing and prove what it is I'm saying.
The thing is now in your manufacture, you have to remember you've got to work it while it's green.
Sure.
Once it cures out, but now because of all the oils in the tree, it takes a long time to really cure.
Sure, but once it's done,
properly
lubricated, because you could make a water jacket for the thing in the same doggone thing. You could take man, you could build a radiator out of wood.
Yes, you could.
So. That would be probably the most brilliant way to prove exactly what I'm talking about. If you get this thing temperature controlled to where it can't get to its breakdown, that engine will never fail.
Right.
It won't catch fire. You can rub two sticks together all you want. You can rub two sticks together for 350,000 years. And if you don't match the frequency and the heat of the breakdown of that, it will never catch fire. You'll wear yourself out before you wear that wood out. Now, if you speed it up and raise the friction and the pressure and the frequency of rubbing the two sticks together, they'll burst into flames. You'll get a fire started rapidly. But every single material out there has a breakdown point. Temperature-wise, it will become too hot or too soft, and it will start eating into the lesser. That's why I said earlier they put in some equipment like electric motors, they'll put little brass or copper bearings in there that the brass or the copper will go bad before the metal. Have you ever seen them slip bearings?
Yeah.
They're in every electrical motor. And as long as there's a tiny bit of grease on them, they'll last for years. But if you take that same motor when you very first buy it, and you put some pre-greased bearings inside there, that electric motor will never generate enough heat to destroy itself.
The locust wood I mentioned is really prevalent in the Allegheny Mountains and the Eastern Mountain Range.
Yeah.
We have found where log cabins used to be that were 150 years old. The log cabin's totally gone, but the foundation logs, they always use locusts, because when it cures, not even bacteria can destroy the stuff.
Yep.
They have 150-year-old locust log foundations for log cabins on the ground, untouched.
Yep.
Look exactly like they was the day they put them down.
That's why they use, around here, they use hedge trees for posts, because the hedge posts...
Hedge trees are the second hardest, most dense wood in the world.
They'll be, those posts to be out there for 100 years and still be good.
Yes. As long as you let it cure without touching the ground, once it cures, then touching the ground, and everybody knows that any piece of wood that touches the ground rots.
Yeah. So I think it's time for a coffee break, and then we'll come back and polish off the last of the Mad Science. What do you think?
I love it.
All right, everybody, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html and say hi.
Never mind that.
Why, that's me.
Look at me! I'm an old man!
Hey, I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing here on the parking lot of...
Thank God I still got my hair! What on earth is this thing I'm wearing?
Well, this is a radiation suit.
Radiation suit? Of course. Because of all the fallout from the atomic wars. This is truly amazing. A portable television studio. No wonder your president has to be an actor. He's got to look good on television.
Whoa, this is it. This is the part coming up, Doc.
This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
What did I just say?
This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Great Scott! What the hell is a gigawatt? How could I have been so careless? 1.21 gigawatts! Tom, how am I going to generate that kind of power? It can't be done, can it?
Look, all we need is a little plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium was available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by. Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're stuck here.
Oh, God, stuck here. I can't be stuck here. I got a wife in 1985. I got a girl.
Is she pretty?
She's beautiful. She's crazy about me. Look at this. Look what you wrote here, Doc. I mean... That says it all. Doc, my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, this might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
The voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
seven cents. They traveled to the world on a silvery light. The people of the earth stood waiting, watching as the ships came one by one. Setting fire to the sky as they landed, carrying to the world children of the sun. Children of the sun. All at once came a sound from inside. The beam of light hit the ground. Yeah.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Yeah, that's right. Could you describe the ruckus, sir? You're listening to Mad Science. That's what the ruckus is. And so we've been joined by Muddy, and we still have Raymond squeaking his chair and that kind of stuff, but it's all good. It's all Mad Science. Hi, everybody. Muddy, Raymond, anybody?
Hello. I'm here.
All right. So, before we went to the doggone break there, we were talking smack about... who wants in? I'll call it. No, I'll... Can you add Patty to the call?
Sure.
Cool. All right. So, like, I'm sitting here trying to... hold on a second. Ta-da! Okay. Thanks for live radio. Alright. So, did you get her added?
I don't have her.
Man! Yarn!
You know, I'll try it. Let me see if I can get her. She's not in my contact list. Huh.
Ta-da! There, she's in the group call. Hi! Hello! Hi. No! Yeah? Let's see if she picks up. Hi, Patty!
Hey!
Hello!
Hey, how come I don't have you in my contact?
I don't know.
Because you're not cool like me.
I tried to make shit bubble and found out you're not even in my contact list.
Ah.
Yeah, you're not cool like me.
That hurt my feelings.
we'll have to remedy that.
Yep. Alright, so folks, what I've been talking about is I started off talking about lightning. And if you look at nature and you pay attention to what nature has to offer, we utilize what nature's already provided in order to be able to enjoy comforts such as electricity, heating, and cooling, and stuff like that. What I've been trying to point out to people for a long time is there's a better way than what we're doing it. We have such an inefficient energy system that it's ridiculousness, not to mention the byproducts and pollution and so on and so forth. We got ways to boil water that make nuclear power look like, you know, just sheer idiocy. And so with that said, you know, I'm talking about a lot of different things here today. I'm talking about, like, how the internal combustion engine, for example, the reason why it tears itself up is because of heat. Heat's a bad thing in an engine. Now, if you are able to control that heat, if you know how to reorganize or send that energy where you want it to go, then you can get that engine to last forever. And because I'm crazy, and because I'm a mad science guy, and because I need to prove what I'm saying, I'm going to put a challenge out there to any woodworker on this planet who has the guts to try to make it into the Ripley's Believe It or Not book, a first internal combustion engine actually made out of nothing but wood. But I have to give you some advice before you go starting this. Doesn't matter which wood you choose, you need to make sure that every single moving part in that doggone engine is all made out of the exact same material. There's a reason for that. The harder materials, and like, let's say you got steel on brass. Brass is a softer material, and so they'll use it in some instance for bearings like in fans and stuff. Well, eventually, that, because they're both producing friction, if you don't keep that greased up, eventually your fan will start squeaking and it'll drive you insane. It'll make you want to pull your hair out. You go over there, spray some WD-40 on the bearings, and it'll stop for a while, but after a while, that WD kind of runs on down. If you find a better lubricant to put in there, like what Raymond was talking about earlier, it's kind of like a Teflon stuff, then it'll never squeak again for a long time. Nonetheless, what happens is when that oil or whatever you use for lubricant finally breaks down, the harder metal will start eating into the softer metal. And even if they were two exact same metals, once it reaches that sweet point in the temperature that metal actually becomes soft and it loses its hardening factor, that is when the damage begins. So if you're able to take away that heat rapidly, you can have an engine made out of the same exact metal that will never destroy itself. As long as it can't reach that temperature where the metal starts to become soft and they start to eat into each other, then it will stay running forever. You'll never have parts that fail. And so with that said, I'm putting a challenge out there to any of the woodworkers of this world. I know there's some really artistic and brilliant woodworkers. Take an old weed eater motor, two-stroke engine, take that thing completely apart, and take the measurements off of every single part, and build it out of whatever particular wood you want. And when you get that thing running, I'll show you how to modify that wood engine so that it never fails. So that you can make sure that the operating temperature of that engine never exceeds the breakdown where, I can't remember the exact temperature, somewhere around about 300 and some odd degrees, paper will burn. If you can never achieve that 300 and some odd degrees, you'll never get that paper to burn. You can rub two sticks together from here until the cows come home, and if you ain't got it at the right frequency and the right pressure, and all the things aren't working together in perfect harmony, you'll never get fire. You'll wear yourself out huff and puff until your face turns blue and the stick will never burn, period. So with that said, using some basic science and some physics and some modern technology along with you know, everything we know about engines, you can literally design an engine that could be made completely out of wood. Plastic, for that matter. It doesn't matter which product. If you got a 3D printer and you want to duplicate one of these engines in plastic, then we'll show you how to run a doggone thing. All you got to do is be able to remove that heat. Now, I got some mechanics out there rolling their eyes and probably calling me some really foul things right about now.
Yeah, I can hear them.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't call me Shazooz if I wasn't a crazy mad science guy. I'm always going to say stuff that's going to shake up the tree of all the people out there in stuck with their face in the school book. Because...
Oh, Dodge engine.
Yeah. Right now, if you look at the nuclear power industry alone, they're using pure ridiculousness. See, they're using some science that we talk about on here all the time, which is frequency, such as microwave frequencies, and there's so many different frequency ranges that you just couldn't count them all, even if you had a trillion, 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 bazillion lifetimes and whatever's higher than that. You couldn't do it. They're everywhere. It's basically how fast and how often something is moving that will determine that frequency. And so with that said, you'd be surprised what you can do with frequencies. Anyway, I'm just trying to point this out because, you know, like I said, the nuclear industry basically takes highly refined radioactive, but basically starts off naturally radioactive, and they essentially compact it really tight, and now it's like really super radioactive. All these things are like, you know, like a, you know, like me on coffee. Alright? I'm running around crazy. And so while these rods are depleting themselves, they're releasing energy, which in turn is releasing energy waves, which in turn is interacting with water molecules that is rocking that water molecule so rapidly that in turn it produces friction, which in turn produces heat. Heat, pressure, or friction and pressure and frequency determines the temperature of anything. And so if you got bearings that are going, let's say, 50,000 RPMs, and these things are not well lubricated, then they will literally heat the metal of that you could actually build a heater. With two electric motors and two steel plates, you could take and build a heater that would heat your house with radiant heat. All right? Put these two plates together, rotate them in the opposite direction, basically touching each other, and they will produce enough friction until those two plates become literally red hot. All right? That heat will transfer down the shaft of that electric motor, which will transfer up and through the rotor itself, which in turn will transfer into the coils of the electric motor and destroy the insulation on that electric motor and cause that electric motor to fail on both sides. Now, if you can take the heat away from those electric motors fast enough using a water cool system or a really good air cool system with a fan blowing across there, you can keep those electric motors from ever being able to absorb enough heat to cause the insulation on the copper windings to fail. So by rubbing these two doggone flat metal discs together, you're going to produce the friction and the pressure to produce the heat. As long as it never reaches the temperature that will break down that metal to the point where it becomes soft and out of balance or whatever and starts eating into each other, those two discs will be just fine. All you got to do is find that sweet point in those metals. Don't have to put no oil in there to lubricate it. You just have to be able to know at what point the temperature will get hot enough to cause the two pieces of metal to fail. Once those two metals fail, then you know that's the point of no return, and then the engine tears itself up, whatever.
Or so, you lose the pump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, after you guys have heard what I just said, can you tell me where it is that I'm wrong? I just quoted everything from the second law of thermodynamics, which says you can't ever get out more than you're trying to put in, and we're not. We're not trying to get out more than we're trying to put in. We're just trying to utilize whatever force that's generated.
All right. Not fair. You quote a bunch of stuff, but that's true, and then you ask, we get a chance to tell you what's wrong. Well, there ain't nothing to talk about then.
That's what I was just getting ready to say. The answer to your question is we cannot tell you what's wrong with what you said because there is nothing wrong with what you said.
Yeah. So, why...
You put some Teflon bearings and some polished shafts. Teflon bushings are better than bearings, and they'll stay cool and have very, very little friction and stuff.
You know, you
have to keep everything inside your engine there, and you'll do okay.
My brother's wife's father was a machinist at the Newport News Shipbuilding Dry Dock before he retired. He's dead now. But anyway, his job, or not his, one of his jobs, one of his annual jobs was to replace a bearing on a sump pump in a sump area where they collected water. And he had to go down in this pit, nasty pit, once a year, every year, for like 15 years, and change just one bearing on this motor. Well, he got tired of it after 15 years, and he, being a machinist, he got a solid block of Teflon and actually put it on a lathe and made a solid Teflon bearing. It wasn't Teflon coated. He made it out of pure Teflon. Put it on the motor. 15 years later, he retired from the shipyard, and another guy, a friend of his, took over his job of replacing that bearing. The thing is, in the 15 years after he changed it, it never had to be changed again. And the other guy worked there for another 10 years, and he never had to change it. So the bearing was still good. After 25 years, they checked it, and it looked like brand spanking new.
Okay, cool. I want to ask Patty a question because she's like not really... seriously mechanically inclined. Not saying anything about Patty because she's got her brilliance where her brilliance is needed. But you think that if we could actually design things like what we're talking about, that it would benefit society there, Patty?
I'm 100% positive that it would, Chaz. The simplicity of design is important. If you have to have these schematics that require certain this, certain that, then you cut out half of the population that doesn't have the means. Everybody's got to
Yeah.
There are two or three plastics that are tougher than Teflon, more friction-free than Teflon, and built at a higher temperature than Teflon. So if you took any one of these plastics from Teflon on up and built the motor entirely out of that plastic, it would take very little lubrication, very little cooling, and it would genuinely last forever with minor, minor maintenance.
Okay, check this out. Patty, you're the one who put in the Skype chat room that paper burns at 451 Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I got that from a book.
That's right. Well, did you know that water boils at 212 degrees?
Yep.
So, we could literally build a heater out of wood and water.
Right.
Bring the thing up.
Well, the implications... Yeah, the implications are really widespread. I mean, couldn't you actually also be able to figure it out for cooling, figure it out for any number of different things, pneumatic tools,
yep.
things like this? Wouldn't that work?
Yeah.
The same principle?
So we know that paper will begin to burn at 451 degrees Fahrenheit, all right? Well, as long as we never allow that energy to exceed 451 and the wood doesn't break down until it actually starts to burn whatever, we could even drop it down to, let's say, 300 degrees and still be able to have it run efficiently enough to boil water. We can also get it to the point where we can turn that water into steam, and that steam can be pressurized, which in turn can go through a condenser and an expansion chamber so rapidly that any gas that you compress gets hot. And whenever you release that gas into an expansion chamber, it instantaneously cools down, like air conditioning.
You know, there's a video on YouTube where a guy took a table saw, put a 2x4 against the side of the blade, but nowhere near the teeth. And of course, in just a few seconds, it started smoking, getting red hot, and the blade actually got red hot. Then
yep.
he put a 2x4, got another blade, got another 2x4, and put one on both sides with spring loaded so it would have the same amount of pressure. That way it wasn't trying to warp the blade. Then he sprayed water on the blade from the same container, just recirculating the water, and I mean, in a matter of seconds, it started that water to boil.
See? Thanks for the calculations there, Patty. I'm glad you remembered that, because I couldn't remember what the ignition deal of paper was, but there you go, folks. 451 degrees it takes to get paper to burn. So with that said, we know that water will boil at 212 degrees, and so you could literally design air compressors and engines and stuff that could be made in a wood shop and water cooled, use the water at the hot spots to boil the water into steam, use the steam pressure to produce cooling effect using heat exchangers. Somebody out there tell me why it is I keep getting called stupid.
You know, the thing is, what a lot of people don't understand is using water to cool something and by turning it into steam, if you've got something that's getting red hot, you pour water on it and it instantly turns into steam, it draws an unreal amount of BTU off the heat off that object. For example, 1 pound of water at 212 degrees Fahrenheit sea level takes 840 BTUs to turn that same pound of water into 212 degrees Fahrenheit steam.
Well,
you've not changed the temperature, but you've extracted a tremendous amount of heat, but you've not increased the temperature one bit.
Well, anything above 212 degrees, water will begin to superheat. And so, with that said, we could have a long time ago built systems that, electric-powered systems that'll boil water. And there's so many different things. Using the things that people say are a bad thing, friction is obviously a bad thing in an internal combustion engine because friction causes damage once it gets to a certain stage.
Right.
So, if you control that temperature and guide it to where you want it to go, you now have a massive amount of powerful energy that you can utilize and store. So
probably a Stirling engine. Take the heat off of your gasoline engine and turn a Stirling engine.
Yeah. That's why I want to build it.
What I'm saying is energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can, however, be changed in shape, form, and or direction. So therefore, you take the heat that you're trying to get rid of because it will destroy this engine. You take that heat and you put it into a heat engine and turn it into electricity.
Yep.
Your engine that's making the heat, the dangerous heat, is making electricity. But you take the dangerous heat off the engine and it lasts longer, but you take that dangerous heat off and you put it into a heat engine that's designed to operate on heat only. So therefore, you double your output of electricity for the same energy.
Yep. So that's the point. The point is we got a whole system out there that's so incredibly inefficient. We know all the science, we know all the physics and all that kind of jazz, and yet we just can't seem to get our act together, man. Look, even when you burn firewood, you end up with more power. You end up with a fuel, you end up with something you can make soap and several other products out of just with the ashes alone. And so it basically shows energy can neither be created nor destroyed. You just turned it into a completely different form of energy.
When you turn it into a different form of energy, figure out how to use that energy. And from it, you're going to get waste and figure out how to use the waste.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again.
So the point in all of this is we literally have the capability to make perfect systems that will work in perfect harmony with nature using everything we know about physics and basic science. And so we can make the people out there who are concerned about the environment happy. All right?
And I've often talked to people about how we need to go to a beneficial society, a cashless society. And they tell me all the time, they say the same thing. Well, if you do that, then what's going to be the incentive for the guys to man the sewer plant? And I said, don't you know that if they told your community that, hey, you got to figure out something to do with this waste, that those guys that have to deal with that would figure out a much better way of dealing with it and innovate and create a system that would not be the bother that it is today. That's the incentive that you have when you don't have any restrictions on you, when there is nobody telling you you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way, because just as it is, you're right. The systems that are created today are not created for benefit. None of them are. They are throwaway systems. They are systems that are cost intrusive and regulated to a point where you can't. The average person has no way to bring these systems into their home. Only those who have the money. And this is wasteful. Everything that we create is wasteful today because it's on a profit driven system.
We could
literally. You get these people. Yeah, you get these people out there, and they're going to say, no, I got a better way, dude. I'm not shoveling that.
I agree.
Yeah. Hey, I'm glad you brought up the sewer systems, because to me that is a pet project that I get very angry over, because human waste is a problem. It's a problem only because we don't deal with it properly.
Exactly.
We could use the sewage to literally...
That thing gas can run automobiles, it can heat homes, it can cook food, and what's left over when you produce that thing gas from human waste is a perfect, absolute perfect liquid fertilizer. Come on, man. I mean, there's nothing unusable about it. The city of Norfolk, Virginia, 3 years ago, built a biodegradable human waste building, and they were turning human waste into methane gas. They converted all city vehicles, even from cars to pickup trucks to dump trucks and garbage trucks, converted all of them to burn methane gas. For 5 or 6 years, they reduced the cost of fuel for these vehicles drastically. But then all of a sudden, they said, oh, I'm sorry, this is no good, and they shut the plant down because they claimed that it was too costly for upkeep.
That's ridiculous.
They tried all kinds of different pipes. It was very corrosive and this, that, and other. That was a forest. It was a lie.
Well,
your gas pipes underground at that time were steel. Just plain black carbon steel. And they'd been in the ground for 60 to 75 years. And they claimed that it was too cost efficient. It was corrosive.
You could literally use the sewage.
To carbon steel. It is not corrosive to carbon steel. It is not corrosive to plastic. It is not corrosive to stainless steel. That it was a lie, an absolute lie. Somebody's son, son-in-law, daughter's whatever, cousin, got a contract to buy gasoline cheap, and they took to shut the plant down.
Yeah.
Just shut it down.
You can
use something.
Let me get this thought out there real quick.
They were uneducated people, so they understand that the law is after money. Government and big business, they don't care. Start doing it ourselves.
Let me get this thought out there. To the people, you could literally use the sewage to run the generators, to run the doggone pumps that actually pump the stuff around. And it's not, like I said, it's all based on science, what Raymond just explained there. And so with that said, Muddy, you had something?
Yeah, around 1981 or 1982. Friend of mine had a motorcycle wreck. Actually, the guy ran over him. And then he backed over him to see what he ran over. And then after he saw what he ran over, he ran back over him again because he was drunk and wanted to get out of there. Well, John Paul lost his his right arm and his left leg. And as a motorcyclist, he wound up having to drive one of them three-wheelers from then on. Well, because I like John Paul a lot, and I was going to robotics at TSTI, Texas State Tech Institute at Sweetwater Roscoe campus, I drew out a full robotic prosthetic arm, and I was going to make some digital circuitry to decipher nerve code endings and all of that stuff. Anyway, well, my robotics instructor stole and patented it. And it never went to market. But when I was going through and showing him, he told me, well, take this part and have this company make it, then take this part and have this company make it, or make it all yourself. And I said, okay, so what are we going to make this out of? He says, well, you got to make it out of various different metals. I said, okay, so what metals are we going to do? And he says, well, which part do you want to wear out first? I said, I don't want any parts to wear out. This is somebody's arm. They've got to buy it. They're going to pay dearly for just like any prosthetic or anything that comes out of medical. He said, I don't want it to wear out. He said, well, you're not going to make any money then.
Right.
That's the point that Patty brought up. If they're not going to make any money, they won't make it.
Yeah, well,
You can only sell somebody one. J. Paul Getty, Millionaire Ship, Top 10 Rules. Number one, you've got to be foreign. That's because us spoiled Americans don't have enough drive as these people coming from overseas who sleep three and four families to a house and live hard. They come over here and it's so easy and they just go gung-ho. That's his point on that. Number two, you must provide a service that is reusable. Because you can only sell somebody one refrigerator, one washer, one dryer, whatever. Or unless it breaks down and has parts that you can replace. That's the deal. Reusable services or parts that break down.
That's why
GM gets you stuff and Ford Motor Company and Chevy and all this stuff. That's why the crap breaks down on your car. That's why you must change your oil, or you would be buying an engine. Enough said.
The reason why society hasn't ever to this extent and probably for a long, long, long time reached the point of enlightenment to where we can literally live on a utopia is because of money. See, we have the capability right now. Everybody's always worried about, well, you know, you do this and you're going to kill off the jobs. I say that's a big hockahooey. Now, first off, nobody wants to go to work anyway. They don't like their job. But if you made their job so efficient that all they had to do was maintain a few things, then they would basically be able to have anything that they needed just for being helping out in society. If you need something at the grocery store, you just go pick it up. If you need something at the electronics store. Huh?
Hey, don't you know how bad
stay logs and wait for a signal and just push a button.
Well,
that's what you're talking about.
You know how much
it's good.
You know how much wind got pulled out of my sails after drawing all this? I mean, I made all the full dexterity of the hand, all three joints of all three fingers, and the thumb, and the full range and everything. You'd have full dexterity, and it took 36 stepper motors. With spring-loaded return and worm gears and cables running through, just like all of the muscles, I copied nature and had this all set up. And, I mean, I spent hours and hours and hours on it.
Well, I understand your frustration because...
I wanted to see somebody be able to put a pen in their hand and not have to use their arm to write like you're supposed to, but do like most people do and using their fingers and all of that stuff. Be able to pick up a dime and do all and run it between the fingers or a quarter like the magician and do all the things that a human could do. And of course the robotics instructor stole my patent.
Many years ago I gave to medical student from Kansas University basically a mechanical muscle that could be. You could build literally an exoskeleton suit for anybody. You wear it like a pair of tight pants. And this thing would lift your leg for you. Alright? And so I gave him the prototype that I put together for essentially a clothing that could be an exoskeleton. You could actually have a glove and this thing would mechanically move your hands for you. Alright? And it could literally be designed to the extent where it could be used for therapy, you know. A lot of the pain of therapy is that you gotta try to force your hand to do something that you don't want to do because it's hurt. But if you got something that's actually moving it for you, flexing it, you're building up the muscle inside that hand. And so the same device, if he would have took it any further than what he did, then you would see modern day suits right now that if a person had no use in their body whatsoever of any of their muscles, that this suit that they could put on wouldn't be big and bulky, using the same technology like they use in fishing string, and basically you could voice command the whole entire system to make you walk, and people would be mobile again. And so I give this to this guy and told him, I said, look, go out and make a fortune on this thing. I don't know where it ever went, but the point in telling that story was that we've had for so long, all the doggone technology to literally make people who can't walk, walk. We got such advancements out there. We got so much knowledge out there. If it was ever to be utilized and people really seriously wanted to have a really decent life where they didn't have to break their back for a living, not saying you ain't gonna get out there and get exercise, because when people get bored, they're gonna go out and have fun, play baseball, and do all the enjoyable things of life, so we don't have to sit around and become like park machine and all that craziness. But the information and the technology has been around for so long. And all the way that we see business and finance and, you know, everything that you do, get up in the morning, go to work, go through the grind, do things for everybody, and, you know, by the time it gets all done, you can distribute your money around to whoever to get whatever it is that you need. We could have a society, if we literally started to build it today, we could have a society that if you needed something, it was there. You'd still go to work like you did, do what you did, but you just wouldn't have to work as hard. There's a saying back in the old days, work smarter, not harder. Most of the people out there, their doggone bodies are failing them because they're doing things that are beyond what the body was intended on doing. And so whenever I went to work for a company, I would look and see, hey man, this is like causing people to have carpal tunnel syndrome in their wrist because they're doing this repetitive deal. Why don't you just take these two pulleys and put them on this machine, push the button and allow the machine to do that. You'll speed up your product and get better products, and you won't have people with burns on their fingers and, bum wrist and stuff. They built three of those machines, costing $25,000 a piece, and they saved them a whole lot of money every week on materials and labor and all that kind of stuff. And so, if you did that in every single industry out there, and people could get past the whole entire system that literally enslaves all of humanity and use the brains, there's no reason why we can't have a perfect world. We only choose to do it because we're complicit and allow people that are in high places to basically tell us what can or can't be done. That's why I'm a rebel against the laws of physics. That's why I'm a rebel against modern mainstream science.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. It's not because I think I'm all-knowing and this cool guy that knows everything, because I don't know everything there is to know. But what I do know and what I do see is there's an easier way to do it than what we're doing, and it doesn't defy any of what I've been taught as the known laws of physics and science. Why ain't we doing it? That's the question. If people in this world don't have fresh water... Huh?
Why we're not doing it is because you can't make any money at it. We're not interested in making money. Therefore, we know how to do it. People that are interested in making money and have the money and the power to do it, there's no money in it for them, so they're not going to do it.
And here's the rub. The people like us are sitting there thinking, I wish I had the money to be able to invest in this solar power. I wish I had the money to be able to invest in these on-demand hot water heaters. I wish I had the money to be able to invest in these wind generators, in these new systems, but I just don't have the money. So I'm going to go and I'm going to continue to pay my electric bills and put tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes a year, into this antiquated system that will continue to rape me and all the other people because I can't afford to get into this system of renewable energy. And it's like there's a disconnect, it's like, yeah, I wish I could do that, but I'm stuck here paying this. I don't want to pay it. I wish I could get into that, but I'm stuck here paying. Wait a minute. Stop. Think about what you just said. If you can afford to pay all these thousands of dollars for your gas, for your electricity, for your house, then how come you can't work with other people and develop these freer forms of energy, these renewable forms of energy, and like you're talking about with creating these machines out of wood, things like this. These are systems that are affordable, that the average Joe can go out and get the materials himself without breaking the bank. Yep. A lot of it, sometimes, you could even go in the woods and come out with a whole machine if you wanted to.
Yeah.
On this principle. We have to get past that block.
Let me put this across at you. Number one, I had a friend who went out of town for about 2 months, came back, and both months they gave him a $650 electric bill with only refrigerator running. He got so mad, trying to argue with him and tell him that he needed a new meter and that their meter didn't work, he told him to yank it off the pole, yank the wire from the house to hold, and they did.
Jim Clugston.
Jim Clugston. Yes, and money that he would normally pay for the electric bill, he went out and pieced it one piece at a time and built him up a decent system. And he was off grid for like 3-4 years. Yep. And happy as could be.
That goes back to what Patty was saying.
Buy one solar panel. You don't have to buy
$10,000 every year to buy one solar electricity and whatever from the corporates. Therefore, you don't
buy one solar panel at a time.
But you have to sacrifice.
You can't afford the whole system. Nobody can. Except the rich people. But
sure,
you can get it one
sure
piece at a time.
Sure you can. My buddy Justin's doing it right now, and he had the same issue with the power company. He told him, yank the doggone power line out of there, or I don't want none of your product anymore, and gradually,
and
incrementally.
One piece at a time.
Yeah. Now he's got a huge power system out there. He could run several houses if he wanted to. The whole point is this. Look, there's a way to do it out there, and if the average Joe seriously wants to do like what Patty was talking about, you get together with your neighbors and you build your own power company. You know, to heck with the government, to heck with the finances and all that kind of stuff. If you calculate out, like right now, if I had some neighbors that were of like mind, my light bill can range from anywhere to almost $200 to maybe all the way up to $600 a month, depending on what time of year it is and what all I'm running.
Well, you haven't seen anything yet. With the deregulation that's been put in place, that's supposed to make everything competitive, you watch what happens. And you think you're paying high energy bills at this time. Next year at this time, you will think that this was the bargain.
Yep.
You know?
That's why we should start all right now. But if I had like-minded individuals, I'd take my $300 a month, I'd tell the power company, shut me off. And I'd rough it for a few months. And I'd take my $300 and go out and buy me a little cheapo generator and run the bare essentials off of that generator and work my way until I finally got completely self-contained a little bit at a time, making it where I use less and less energy and that generator has to work less and less hard.
That
generator uses gas, and I tell you what, that gasoline costs.
Sure, I wouldn't be using gas. I'd put a wood gasifier to it, because the technology is available.
You just
said the secret, you just didn't use the right word. The right word is you have to sacrifice a little bit first.
Yep.
Definitely is a sacrifice.
But if you prove to your neighbors that it can be done and they want off of doggone power grid, want to be able to save some doggone money, then they would do the same thing. And eventually, our society built right alongside the mainstream society, eventually the mainstream society becomes irrelevant and money's no longer an issue, because everybody knows right now, if I got a bushel of corn and I want some beans, I'll just swap my neighbor with it. You know?
There you go.
So,
well, you know, when me and Mark, we were out on a half acre, and we were on electricity. Well, because of where we were rural, we were not in a city. We were out in the country, and they have the little private electric companies, right? Well, they can charge whatever they want. They were charging. We were living in a bus, right? My bus. And they charged us $300 to $400 a month in electricity, right?
Wow.
So we decided we can't do this. And there's my pup out there. But he's got his head stuck through the cat door, and that's, you can see his head, but you can't see the rest of him. But anyway, you know, what we did was we got a generator, and all we had was this little, the little bitty refrigerators, you know, not even an apartment size, one, a camper size.
Mini fridge.
And, right, a mini fridge. And we kept only the things that were essential that needed to be cooled. We bought our meals, we planted our garden and the grasshoppers just took it over. I mean, they wiped us out. As soon as the sprouts came up, they were gone. So we had to, go in and purchase. But you can do that very cheaply. And people say, well, you can't go buy groceries on a daily basis. Oh, yes, you can. And it's a lot cheaper sometimes, because when you go in there on a daily basis, you look at the vegetables. You know, they throw them away as soon as they start looking discolored or whatever. That's when they're actually the most nutritious. So we ate really well. We had electricity for cold water. We wanted water to keep some things cool and everything. And it was a most remarkable time for us, because there is a solitude and a comfort when you know that what you're doing is being, it's already paid for. You're not going to get a bill at the end of the month. You're not going to have to worry about paying your mortgage. You're not going to have to worry about paying your electric bill. Your food is taken care of.
Nothing's spoiled.
Right. We could hook up the computer for a couple of hours a day and enjoy talking to people and stuff like this. This isn't, people are afraid because they become so accustomed to having everything at the fingertip, to being able to push the button and have whatever they need done, you know. And so they become so accustomed to living in this way that they cannot fathom having to do without. That's a sacrifice. They think that's just too great. But there's a difference, because when you separate yourself from this system, another type of empowerment comes over you, and it fills you with a freedom that we haven't had, that this society doesn't allow. And with that empowerment and that freedom, you can look to a future where you can even improve on what you're doing, all within the bounds of nature, all within the bounds of renewable systems.
Yep.
And as you implement them one by one, by one, by, you know, a solar shower. We had a solar shower. You know what we did? We filled a big tank of water on the back of the bus, and we had this ramp, a hydraulic ramp, and we put a curtain around it. Man, nice hot shower. You know, and then on a hot day, we could bring in the cold water and do it that way. There are so many ways. You don't miss it. It's not that you're doing without. You're doing it in a different way, without all the chains and shackles.
That's a perfect point. That's what I've been trying to point out to everybody and his brother forever. See, right now, we're at a crossroads that you give it 20 years down the line, and right now you're already under the thumb of the power company and the government for taxes and so many different, so you're not truly free if you're living in, you know, modern society. And the more that technology advances and the easier things seem to be, will not change the fact that you're still going to be a slave to the system. Because right now, if you don't pay your power bill, all they gotta do is flip a switch and turn your lights off. And then you're at the mercy of them charging you for a doggone, deposit and whatever it is to get your lights back on. Average Joe don't have that kind of funds. And so the more it gets more advanced where you ain't even got a clue on how it even functions to begin with, the more you're gonna be underneath the thumb of the system that right now you despise.
And think about it. I mean, paying $300 a month for the electric bill for an RV camper. What could you do with $300 a month that didn't have to go to an electric company?
Patty, think about this a minute. If you want a refrigerator for 2 months to keep a vegetable fresh, how much energy does it take to put that same piece of vegetable, cut it up in pieces, and put it in a food dehydrator? You're only going to have it there for 10 or 12 hours, and it's dehydrated enough. You don't need refrigeration. You put it in a plastic
bag. Right.
It's put it on the shelf, and it'll last 6, 8 months, 10 months. Well, it'll last over a year.
Your meat can be done the same way.
Exactly. It's called beef jerky, and if you do it right, you get the right recipe, it is delicious.
Well,
and these freeze dryers now, they have freeze dry systems, which to me are brilliant. Home freeze dry systems.
Electricity to produce the food in a situation of where you don't need refrigeration. It'll last, but good beef jerky done right will last for about a year.
Well, listen, guys, I don't have
no. You put your vegetables on a piece of wood in the shade, they'll last longer than they do in your fridge.
Listen, guys. I don't have no sponsorship on this website, so I don't have any people that I advertise for money or anything, but there is a company out there called Missouri Wind and Solar. I can't remember what actual portion of Missouri they're in, but if you get on their website, you can look them up, Google them, Missouri Wind and Solar. They have windmills as low as a couple hundred dollars, under $300 that you can buy, that will put out their permanent magnet generators and put out enough power. You could have ran that bus off of wind power and supplemented it with solar power, and they also sell solar there too. They sell everything, charge controllers, battery backups, and all that kind of stuff. Now, there's other companies out there, but if you...
Well, that's what we did with our generator. We didn't have the solar, but we just charged banks of batteries.
Yeah.
You know, we ran the generator for about 2 hours a day and charged our batteries, and that carried us through. But you learn, too, when you're living in that way, you learn to respect energy. You learn to respect the fact that there are responsibilities that come straight down to you. It's not flipping the switch and where you forget about, oh, there's no oil burning those turbines that are giving me this electricity. You become conscious of what you're doing. That in itself is important. We no longer think about the consequences of the energies we use, where they come from, and what they're taking from the earth. When you are conscious of that and you are responsible for providing your own energy, you see the system working, you know how it's working, and you become a part of that. It becomes a part of you. You have an understanding of nature. You have an understanding of how things work, and you are more responsible with what you do.
Yeah. You know, and if you ain't using the lights, just shut them off. Save some power. It's that simple.
You know, we went and got these little solar lights. We take them outside, the yard lights. You take them outside during the day and you charge them up. You bring them in at night. You put them in a jar and they work as a lantern.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. I've never thought about that.
Yeah.
I put them on their side of the window.
That is an excellent idea.
Well, the whole...
I'm a forgetful fella. I put them on their side in the window, and then when the light, well, as soon as the sun goes down, they come on. It works pretty good that way.
The whole point is to let everybody know you got options available out there to you. You don't necessarily have to be enslaved to the system if you don't want to be. And, you know, like I said, if you wait too long and the society gets more complex, the more complex it is, the less likely you're going to be able to fight against the system and get out there and be free and change the world, you know. Sometime they might come out with some energy efficient stuff, because by that time they'll have some other way to make money off of you. That's how it goes, all right? But if you want to take control of your future and your children's future, now's the time to do it. You have the vast sum of all man's knowledge, what my friend Simply Steve always says, right there at your fingertips. You got the brilliant minds on this panel and every other place out there talking about alternative methods and medicines and foods and stuff like that. And, you know, folks, it's there. It's been there all along. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it. You know, I call it mad science for a reason. You know, I'm going to build a wooden engine just so I can prove what I said. You know, we know the breakdown temperatures of every material out there. The science has been done for you. All you got to do is take advantage of that. If you build an engine out there and you got a softer metal basically used as a bearing for a harder metal, it's obvious what's going to happen over time. The softer metal is going to wear out, and if you don't replace it in time, it'll destroy itself, and you'll have to buy a new engine. That's the way they were made, so that they would fail. Light bulbs are made to fail. Everything that you got, including your computer that you own, is made to fail. You got people that go out there and they spend $200,000-$400,000 or more for fancy houses that are so energy inefficient that it's ridiculous. Take that same $200,000-$400,000 or above and design that house from start to finish using some basic science and physics and everything known about materials, and that you'll have a house that will literally pay for itself, because you're not going to be paying no electric bill anymore. They passed a law somewhere in California, may be all of California, by a certain date, every house has to be 0 point, which means the house is its own generating system, and it reduces the carbon footprint. Now, somebody out there believes it's possible, but those same somebodies are the ones that are going to be selling the solar panels and the wind generators and the thermoelectrics and all that kind of stuff to you. I would say instead of spending thousands and thousands of dollars, get a little bit of knowledge under your belt and start working the system just like Patty explained in that bus. And they took it what they needed, and then when they needed a little bit more, they readjusted and they made it happen. And they didn't waste energy. They only used what they needed. They even found creative ways to have lighting with the solar light, she explained. Put it into a jar and make a lantern. You know? So, it's brilliant.
Patty, where do you live?
I live in Kansas, land of the flat.
What I live in?
Kansas.
Kansas?
No place like home.
Ah!
Dorothy left a while ago. Yeah.
Patty, just to make sure so we can face to face, next time I go up to Shizu's place, he's not that far from you, I'm going to bring you 4 solar panels.
Yeah. That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
I give Shazam's 10 or 12 of them. I can probably afford to give you 5 or 6.
Do you make them?
No, ma'am. They were given to me because they were hailstorm damaged, but they still work. They were originally 450 watt panels, but because of the hailstorm breaking the glass on them, some of them dropped down to 150 watts, some of them are still 250 watts. So, on the average, they run about 225 watts each, on the average. So if I went 5 or 6, that would give you over 1,000 watts.
It's tough.
That would give me more than what I need for my bus, man. Yeah.
That's really what I want. I want you to have more than you need, so you don't ever have to work.
It's time to go again, but before I go, I want to point out to everybody about these solar panels that Raymond's talking about. I've got 2 of them, but if you go look in my video series, Free Thinkers, you'll see that I've got 2 of them that are laying on the ground, and they have been laying on the ground for, I don't know, about a year now, it seems like, since Raymond was down here with those.
About 2.5 years to do this.
And either way, these things are still producing electricity. They've been in the rain, they've been in the snow, they've been laying in the dirt, and they are still, to this very day, producing electricity. So those things are more durable than you could possibly imagine. The only reason why anybody got rid of them because they got old, they got a little bit of hail damage, and they weren't as efficient as they were when they first came out. But nonetheless, they're still producing electricity. So you can go out and buy some reclaimed ones or maybe get some for free or whatever if you're in the right place at the right time. But nonetheless, they ain't wasted. I'm still using some.
Well, I'm about a 3 to 4 hour drive from Shaz.
No joke.
No joke. I'm just south of Wichita.
So will.
She is. We got a family coming up to see you sooner than we thought, just so we can get together and take Patty some of these solar panels.
Yep. And so, anyway, folks, there's options out there available. Going to do a few crazy things to prove some science that I shouldn't have to prove. If people would have paid attention in science class, they might already know it themselves. You know, we're not trying to define any known laws of physics or any basic science for that matter. It's all about making things so efficient that you don't have to waste anything. And I don't even have to say it. If you get a $300 light bill, then there's some waste going on, and somebody's getting fat, stinking rich off of it. So,
yeah. And it isn't you.
Yeah, and it ain't you. Imagine what each one of us could do with an extra $300 or $400 a month towards building some of the stuff we're talking about.
Oh yeah.
Just imagine that if you were hard at working 40 hours a week, and you knew that you had to get paid at Friday because you have to pay that electric bill, you have to pay that gas bill, and you don't have the money. It's going to take everything you got. But yet, on the other hand, you've got your whole house set up as efficient as possible, running on alternative energies, renewable energies, and when you get your paycheck, all that's going out of it is maybe a few hundred bucks, and the rest is for you.
That's right.
Look at that. Look at that, you know?
And, you know, if you know the basic science, heat rises and cold falls, you'll know how to do your heating efficiently. If you know that your refrigerator is wasting heat, you can recapture that heat or reuse the heat for generating electricity, charge batteries or cell phones. Instead of plugging something else new into the wall, you use something that's already going to be running anyway and utilize that force to do the even more work. The more you cut
off... if you don't know any of that, then you tune in every Saturday to Mad Science, and you post your questions in the chat, and they get answered, and then you know.
Yep.
There you go.
Brilliant. Thanks, Patty. That's the easy way, folks. We're giving this information away for free. We're trying to help you out. You know, if you take, like Raymond talked about earlier, and switch over from fluorescent lighting to LED lighting, you save energy. If you unplug things that you're not using, you save energy. And the more money you save back, the more you could buy extra solar panels to supplement your energy yet even further. It might be a gradual pace if you're broke, but, you know, a little bit at a time. And even recycling things that we've talked about here on the show, like old washing machine motors that are, you know, permanent magnet in there, you could build wind generators. Muddy shows how you can take and carve a prop out of a 2x4. He's even got the mathematics worked out to what wind speed and all that kind of stuff.
And I do it with free energy, too.
Yep. Yeah, so there you go. He's using solar power to charge batteries and run his inverters and such or whatever. He's using the generator from the windmill to run. That's the whole thing. Once we get started, it's kind of like, when you get something going, it may take a little bit of energy to get you rolling, but once we get going, folks, all of us, we the people, there's 9 billion people on the planet. If we start off a movement forward and we get rolling, there ain't nothing gonna stop us, and ain't nothing gonna be able to stand in our way. Period. We the people do have power if we choose to use it. That's the point. So, you guys got anything last to say before we bail up out of here?
We, the people, have the power. We just need to get together. E pluribus unum.
Yep. How about you, Patty?
I just think the best thing that you can do today is to sit down and make a list, pro and con. Make a list of what electricity and the electric companies and all the fuel companies, anything that is pro and con on them, and then make a list of your alternative energies. And make a list of pro and con. And if you can't come to the right decision after doing that, then you're living in the dark, you know?
Yep.
There are better ways, better systems, and you are better off putting your money into those than you are putting them into a system that is simply going to sponge up everything that you make and not give you anything.
Yep. What about you, Muddy?
The only thing I know is don't worry about the price of the 2x4, if you're going to put a nick in it and ruin your prop as you start, go to the videos, learn how to carve a prop. You'll figure out all sorts of things to do with that prop. The first time you see it spinning up, you'll be addicted to carving props. And if you just get one skill like that, or you take a sealant band motor and put some magnets in it, you'll find a use for that too. I mean, it doesn't cost much. A 2x4 costs $2.76, and you can make two props out of it. Oh my goodness, don't worry about putting that first nick in there. The number one thing you gotta remember is just do it.
Yep. In the old days.
Do it.
In the old days, they had no choice but to do it. But they figured out ways to light and heat their doggone deal with the resources that were available. They made candles out of beeswax and even got to have the honey on their toast. Right? Necessity's the mother of invention. And if you work in harmony with nature... Huh?
If you need motivation, just cuss your electric company out. They'll pull a wire and they'll cut everything and you'll have to do it. Then you have motivation.
Yeah.
And you won't worry about nicking that piece of 2x4. So that we learned that from Mr. Clugston.
If you work in harmony,
bad attitude save you money once in a great while, and he did.
Yep. If you work in harmony with nature, you'll find out one thing, that nature will smile on you and give you exactly what you need. This world is no reason for anybody to be starving. Ain't no reason for anybody to be cold or too hot or, you know, whatever. We have all the tools and technology to make sure that there is no homelessness and all that. It's got to be we, the people, who decide that enough is enough, and we back out of the system slowly but surely and just keep moving forward. Build a society right along the society that we don't like. Unfortunately, we're like so attached to this system that we can't just jump out, like, you know, it'd be nice if we could. But
and if you work in harmony with your electric company, you'll be a slave the rest of your life.
Yes. The system's going to make you a slave. The system has made you a slave, and people are getting more rich off of your hard labors and your ill health and stuff like that. And if you're tired of it, join us over here at ShazizRadio.com, and together we'll teach each other how to resolve the issues before us. So that's the Mad Science Show for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed it and learned something. Thank you, Patty and Raymond and Muddy. Been a brilliant show as usual. We just seem to be getting good at this. Am I wrong?
Right. We're good at it. We're good at it.
Brilliant.
Pat ourselves on the back.
I love this
show.
You deserve
it.
All right, everybody. That's what we're working on, and we'd like to have your help and join in with us. So there's a lot of knowledge out there to be utilized.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.